direct the Court of Appeals is now in session. May all who come here be heard. May truth and justice be served by what we do here.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the November session of this panel of the Court of Appeals. We're pleased to be sitting in Kearney, Nebraska. It's always nice to get out of Lincoln and be in greater Nebraska. We appreciate the county letting us use these facilities. My name is Frankie Moore and I'm from North Platte. And to my left is Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln. And to my right, Judge Dave Arterburn from Papillion. We have three cases on the call this morning. And the first one is Bott versus Praga. Council may approach. And as a reminder, we are audio recording these arguments and they'll be available on our judicial branch website as archived arguments. So to the extent you have anything sensitive this morning, please keep that in mind. With that, we may begin. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Mark Porto. I'm here today on behalf of the appellants, Duvall and Mega Bott, who I'll collectively refer to as the Botts. This case has a complicated procedural history, had a lot of complicated issues at trial, but I think that for the purposes of this appeal, it's rather straightforward and simple. To provide some background, in 2006, the Botts and the appellees, the Patels, formed a company called Pragya to operate a hotel in the Grand Island area. The Botts received 50% of the stock of Pragya, and the Patels received the other 50%. In addition, the Patels put up $340,000 of their own funds to found the business and to purchase the property that it would operate out of. And the Botts, and this all occurred on March 24th of 2006, signed a promissory note for $152,500 payable to the Patels. And that promissory note was secured by their stock pursuant to a stock pledge agreement. Importantly, the promissory note specified how the money was to be repaid from the Botts to the Patels over a period of time. And specifically, the promissory note said that the Botts agree that all distributions received by the Botts from Pragya after the payment of federal and state income taxes due on said distributions will be applied to the principal and interest of the note. The Patels agree to accept such amounts as full annual payments.
And it's your contention that was the sole requirement is through the distributions, that there weren't any other payments due if there were no distributions.
That's correct. And
of course, the Patels differ in that. So my first question is, does that make this note ambiguous if we have differing interpretations?
No. The plain language of the note is, by its own terms, unambiguous, is what my response would be to that. Over the course of time, there was $273.08 in payments that were made from Pragya directly to a combination of sometimes both Patels, sometimes one Patel. But everybody agreed that $273 was provided from the company to the Patels, and each side had a different characterization of what that money was for at trial. The district court found that, in essence, those were distributions.
And that's not challenged.
Not challenged by either party. That's correct. And so, but nevertheless, I should clarify that was also the only distributions that ever went from Pragya to any of the parties.
Well, again, that's contested at this point, is it not?
Well, it's contested by the Patels, that's correct, but the tax records from the company reflect that no distributions were ever made.
What did the accountant say about that?
The accountant agreed that there were no distributions made, and that those there's a line item in the tax returns that specifically reflects distributions that are zero for every year.
Did those tax returns reflect the distributions to the Patels from 06 to 09?
No, it didn't. It did not reflect.
You're treating them as distributions.
Right, and nobody has challenged that.
So let's fast forward then. What about the evidence regarding usage of corporate funds by your clients mm-hmm. during their management of the hotel.
So that was a significant issue at trial. And again, the accountant, the company's accountant, who was also the Patel's accountant and had been the accountant for the company since the Patel's took it over, I believe, in around 2014. They had exclusive access to all of the corporate records, and those tax returns that show no distributions were never amended.
Wasn't there an acknowledgement by the boss or one or the other that they went above and beyond their salary and used some of the corporate funds to pay for personal expenses? And there was no disagreement about that, correct?
So there the evidence was that the company did not have a credit card. And so Mr. Bott would basically use his own personal credit card for expenditures and then repay himself through Pravia funds. And I think the evidence, I feel comfortable in acknowledging that the evidence did show that there were some personal funds or personal expenditures that were ultimately paid with.
Yeah, about a half a million between 2006 and 2013.
So that's, I would disagree with the characterization of that. And not
is some
only,
of that salary?
A lot of that was salary, yes.
What's the evidence as to the salary that was to be paid to the bots for running the business?
I can't remember the specific figure, but there was an agreed upon salary.
You have an approximate?
I believe I want to say it was somewhere around $50,000 a year. Some
for both of them, or
right.
each?
Right. No, for Mr. Boss.
Okay.
Yes.
So $50,000 in salary. So all the other money that was used out of the corporation, you don't want to call a distribution, but it really was, wasn't it?
I don't agree with that. I think distribution, the word distribution reflects a specific legal connotation of, you know, a decision by the corporation to divvy out money to its shareholders.
But that wasn't done with regard to the $200,000, was it?
That was not done with regard to the $200,000. I acknowledge that, but
the accounting is kind of a mess.
The accounting is very much a mess, and there's no disagreement about that. But I want to go back to your questions about those funds and specifically the account, because what was clear from the testimony from the Patel's account is that they could not identify or come up with any of even an approximation of what was actually, to any reasonable degree of certainty, legitimate corporate expenses that Mr. Bott paid for and what.
But you agreed that he had acknowledged that he did use corporate money for personal funds, and that wasn't paid back or reimbursed to the corporation. He kept it, used it for personal funds. So if that was not his salary, he didn't want to call it a distribution, but arguably it was the equivalent of a distribution.
That ended up being the case. Now, there's a disagreement about whether that was intentional, whether that was mismanagement, what have you, but I would acknowledge that there was, that it was clear that there were some expenditures that were paid through the corporation that benefited the bots personally. I would acknowledge that.
Because your position is they didn't have to pay on this promissory note because there were no distributions, but you could easily undermine that by not actually formally, you know, calling it a distribution and going through and putting it on your tax returns, but to spend the money, the excess money that the corporation was making, is really the equivalent of giving yourself a distribution.
So I it could be, but we don't even know what that figure is. We don't know what that number is.
Do we have to know the number or just know that it wasn't paid towards promissory?
Well,
I think
we
didn't make promissory notes after 2009. The bots didn't, when they were receiving some benefit from the corporation above their salary.
So I think you still need to know that number because we need to know what's left on the promissory note.
Well, we know what's left. We know what was unpaid, right?
We know what has not been paid yet on the promissory note.
Mm-hmm.
Directly. That's correct. But we just have no idea.
Well, that's not, well, Exhibit 18 reflects a number of transactions over the years representing personal transactions. Is that not enough information to determine that there were significant personal use?
So I think the question that in regards to the characterization of being significant is unclear. It's by the own testimony from the Patels and Pragya's accountant, unable to identify what were personal expenditures and what weren't. There was an attempt to some degree, but he acknowledged that he didn't know. He couldn't characterize a lot of these things. There could be legitimate business expenditures for a lot of things that the Patels characterized as personal expenditures for the Botts. And he acknowledged that he couldn't, with any degree of certainty whatsoever, nail down what was and was not personal expenditures. The Patels and the business never amended any tax returns to reflect that there were distributions made, despite having complete access for many years prior to trial of all the corporate books. So I don't agree that there were distributions made as the term distributions, I believe, was intended.
What would you call those payments to himself or to cover personal credit cards, to cover trips? What would you call that then?
So, some of those, again, it's in the eye of the beholder, but there was testimony and there was pushback that all of these were for just personal use. So, for example, there were trips to Sam's Clubs and things like that could have been for personal use, but also had, and the accountant acknowledged, very well could have had a reasonable business purpose as well. And so, you know, I would call that mismanagement. I would call that, negligence, but I would not call that a distribution, because a distribution has a specific connotation under the terms of the agreement and legally, which means, you know, this is a decision by the business to pay out its profits to its shareholders, and that never occurred.
Does the court have a duty, though? It sounds like all these problems were created by the Botts. I mean, they didn't do proper accounting. They didn't keep track of what was personal and what was for the business, and now years later, nobody can figure that out. So, you know, didn't that put the court in the position of having to make a call one way or the other as to who bears the sting or the loss there because of that?
So, potentially, but I think it's important to also take a step back and realize what the court actually did. There was never a factual finding that this money was misappropriated and therefore that was a distribution. That's not the finding the court made. The finding that the court made was that this was a demand note rather than a note that had specific repayment terms. And so the court didn't even get to that analysis. There was never a factual finding of, oh, hey, there were distributions that were made to the Botts. The finding that the court made that is now subject to the appeal, the only thing that is subject to appeal is the court's finding that this was a demand note. And so therefore, when the Patels made demand on the note, it became immediately due and payable. And that is not correct.
Disagree with that and say, for instance, we think the court should have interpreted the contract consistent with the appellees. What do we do? Do we have to send it back since there were no factual findings on the alleged misappropriation?
Yes, I think there would need to be factual findings made as to precisely what, if anything, was misappropriated and constitutes a distribution. But the Patels had, I mean, that's what we did at trial. And the court did not make that factual finding. It's only factual.
It didn't make the opposite. Like there was no evidence or insufficient evidence of.
That's correct. The finding that the court made was that this was a demand note, and that's all the finding that occurred. And to that, I would just say that I believe that the court has de novo review over that determination, given that all the court needs to do is review the contract, the promissory note, and the company and stock pledge agreement between parties. I believe I'm out of time, so.
Yes, you are.
I appreciate
that. And we've allowed that.
All right. We have to move that light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Agency. You could move it closer to their side of the table. In any event, how much time did we take the appellant over?
3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Would you add 3 minutes to the appellee's time? And I note there are two counsel here. Are you just one presenting or?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. McKinsey works for the appellees, Pragya, or as we'll refer to them as the appellees, the Patels. Okay. May it please the court. Again, my name is McKinsey Wirtz, and I will kind of take off where Mr. Dupuy ended there, because I think it's very important to note that the appellants in their appeal specifically disagree with the lower court's characterization of the note as a demand note, and even articulate in their appeal brief that if the promissory note was correctly characterized by the district court as a demand note, then the court's decisions to order foreclosure on the note and its determination as to the total amount outstanding for that foreclosure, the remaining balance owed under that note, would be correct. So I'll focus on the fact that it's our position that the lower court did correctly characterize the note as a demand note for the following reasons. I think first and foremost, Your Honors, that the Nebraska UCC 3-108 specifically states that a promise or order for payment is payable on demand if it either states that it's payable on demand or at site, or otherwise indicates it's payable at the will of the holder, or, and this is a subsection, does not state a time of payment. And the case law cited by the lower court in their judgment, as well as cited throughout our briefs, hangs its hat on the language in Erickson, which indicates that a note containing no due date means a note not containing a final date of payment or an amortization schedule.
But here we have an acceleration clause as well, don't we?
We do, Your Honor. And I also provided additional case law in my brief that outlines cases in Nebraska where the appellate court determined that just because an acceleration clause is contained within a note does not take it outside the bounds of being a demand note. I think that's significant because both of the case, both Erickson and the case, and that would be Community First State Bank versus Deringer, they outline the specific language in the notes that they're referring to and analyzing throughout their decisions. In both of those cases, the court indicates the specific language contained in the notes. And in Community First State Bank, both notes were classified and determined to be demand notes. The analysis of the courts determined that they were demand notes. In Community First State Bank, the notes contained specific payment schedules, and both notes provided that if the defendant in that case failed to make payments as detailed in each note, the bank could declare all sums owed pursuant to an acceleration clause. So I think that case there, Your Honor, outlines that an acceleration clause does not remove the possibility of it also being a demand note.
So let's jump forward, and if we disagree that this is a demand note, then we still have evidence of default.
That's correct, Your Honor. And under the note, I think if it's not considered a demand note under Erickson, as the judgment stated by the lower court, then we still have clear default. We have demand made under the acceleration clause, and that dates back to 2010, where there are clear distributions, as was discussed by the appellant in this court, clear distributions made to the appellants after 2010, whereas there is no evidence that any distributions were paid equally to our clients after 2009. The last payment documented from Pragya to our clients was in 2009.
So the appellant's argument is those personal expenditures, or whatever we're going to call them, I'm not saying they were, okay, alleged, that those were not distributions, and then their position is the sole method of repayment is through distributions, and since there were none, they weren't in default. So what's your best response to that argument?
My best response to that, Your Honor, is that our expert, Rodney Wolf, determined that, the appellant was correct. or he testified that he could say with no absolute certainty the amount of distributions, but he said the only way to classify those payments made to the BOTS would be corporate distributions. He could not come up with a specific amount, but the only way through corporate law to classify those were corporate distributions. And although he could not come up with a certain amount, Mr. Bott himself admitted that there were personal payments made to him for his own expenses. There was extensive testimony offered going through itemized receipts where there were significant personal expenses paid on a credit card. And at the end of the month, the entire balance of the credit card was paid by the Pragya account, the business account. So there was.
So do we need to know the amount?
No, Your Honor, and that was going to be my point. The appellant admitted to paying for personal expenses through business accounts, and I don't think we need to have a specific amount for in order to show that they had a corporate distribution. That corporate distribution was not repaid to the appellees, therefore they're in default under the note, in default as of 2010 when there were no, in March of 2010 when none of those corporate distributions were repaid under the note to the appellees.
So your position is if we found that this wasn't a demand note, we wouldn't need to send it back?
That is my position, Your Honor. I don't see that there's any difference in the ultimate result, because I think the note was a demand note, and it also contained an acceleration clause, which our clients acted under, and they acted under both of those provisions of the note. They made demand for the repayment, and then they filed the counterclaim for foreclosure on the note per the acceleration clause.
But the district court didn't make any factual findings with regard to these alleged distributions, right?
So I think they made factual findings in concluding that there were absolutely no payments made from Pragya to our clients after 2009, mm-hmm. and determining, although perhaps not specifically determining factual, but adopting Exhibit 18 and determining that the default happened in 2010, which through the evidence presented at court, through the itemized receipts and the testimony of Mr. Bott, indicated that he began using corporate funds for himself and there were no further distributions to our client in 2010. So I believe because the court adopted that Exhibit 18, the payment schedule that dated the due date, the date of default back to 2010, that's a factual finding that there were no payments made to our clients after 2009. There were clear payments made directly from the corporation to the opposing party or the appellants in 2010. Therefore, they stated the date of default was in 2010. I would agree that the judgment itself does not outline that specific finding, but it adopts that finding in adopting the evidence that was presented to the court that default occurred in 2010.
So whether a demand note or focusing on the acceleration clause, your position is the record sufficient to support either approach?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the record is abundantly sufficient to support either. The case law in Nebraska, I think, specifically outlines that under the case law, under the statutes, that this can be considered a demand note and demand was made for full repayment. If that's not the case, there was sufficient evidence on the record, abundant evidence on the record that there was default under the note. So I think either way, the default or the date of repayment is in 2010 and the court's calculation of the amounts due and owing is the same. Back to, I guess, why I would contend that this is a demand note. Erickson, or appellants really hang their hat on the Solar Motors decision. And Erickson was determined in 1968. And although it was determined earlier in time than the case which the appellants rely on, Solar Motors, which was determined in 1996, Solar Motors did not overturn or even distinguish itself from the Erickson finding. And I think that's, you know, a red flag as to the applicability of both of these cases to the classification of a note as a demand note. And I would propose that is because Solar Motors does not actually discuss or analyze what makes a demand note. The decision in Solar Motors specifically states this is a demand note. It even says a demand note form. It doesn't discuss any of the actual provisions in the note that's being reviewed by the court as to why it's classified as a demand note. Instead, It analyzes the language of the Nebraska UCC statute and determines if that UCC statute can be applied to making demand without good faith and fair dealings. That's the holding of that court. That's why it doesn't overturn Erickson. That's why it's not cited in later cases as to what makes something a demand note. It's merely utilized by the Nebraska courts as determining that the applicability of Nebraska UCC 3-108 does not require good faith and fair dealings in making a demand. So,
What specifically about the wording in this promissory note do you rely upon to characterize it as a demand note?
Specifically that there's no due date. And that's what the lower courts did, Your Honor.
Because there's no ultimate, like, maturity date
that's
on
correct.
It? Because the language of it really sets out these installments and what the expectations are on an annual basis, that the payments would be made from whatever the distributions. So because it's lacking a maturity date, you're saying that alone is enough to turn this into a demand note?
I wouldn't hold myself to that alone, but I do think the case law indicates that is sufficient. Erickson specifically, the demand note in Erickson is very similar to that in our case. It contains from the date of signing, an initial payment date a year out from the initial date of signing. It contains an interest rate included in the demand note as well in the case in Erickson, but it doesn't contain a final due date.
But are we not to some degree ignoring the language that says that any one or more of the following events should happen, there should be a default? So it seems like you're saying you have it both ways. You can treat it, and is that the intent of the note here?
To have it both ways?
I mean,
I think so, Your Honor. I think it is. And I think the case law indicates that doesn't remove it, because it has this acceleration clause, it doesn't automatically remove it from it being a demand note. And I think thinking logistically, it wouldn't make sense that an acceleration clause would remove something from being a demand note.
Is the Community First Bank the only case that you think speaks to that issue?
No, Your Honor. Actually, I would say that Solar Motors does as well. Solar Motors indicates that...
Well, Solar Motors says that a demand note that parties have to agree that a payment will be made whenever demand is made, and the demand can be made any time for any or no reason. And I really don't see that the language in this promissory note makes that kind of demand, that it's like it has to be due now, right?
Under the first section of UCC 3-108, that's the first section, but it's split into two subparts, and it says, yes, at site is section A, or section Roman numeral 1. Roman numeral 2 indicates or contains no due date. So it's an either or.
But there is a due date in this note. It's due annually on March 24th of every year.
And I would think my interpretation of the Erickson case law is that the due date as utilized
is the maturity date.
Is the maturity date, yes. And I think that's how the statute reads. So it's not a due date as for a regular date of payment, but rather when the final note becomes due and owing. So if it doesn't contain that final maturity date, due date, then it's considered a demand note under the UCC 108. I said earlier that I think Solar Motors also doesn't necessarily determine that just because something contains an acceleration clause, it's not a demand note. And that's because Solar Motors indicates the default and acceleration portion of the promissory note. Again, does not apply when the note is a demand note. So this is interesting. Again, I said that Solar Motors doesn't explicitly lay out all of the provisions of the note that they analyze. And so I don't know exactly how to interpret this. But based on the statement in Solar Motors, it would make me think that the note that they're reviewing contains an acceleration clause and is a demand note. But because they made demand, the acceleration clause and the good faith and fair dealings requirement of the acceleration clause doesn't apply to their ability to also make demand. If they were going to demand under the acceleration clause, which I think this case indicates the note in Solar Motors actually does contain as well, if they were going to act under the acceleration clause, they would have to act with good faith. but...
Counsel, and I was hesitant to interrupt you in the middle of your sentences, but you are out of time. I didn't know if you could see the light, so...
Thank you for pointing out.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
We appreciate your appearance here today, and your case is submitted, and you are excused.